KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right life, peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood, Hollywood.
This week on The Business, Vince Gilligan, creator of the AMC show Breaking Bad. He talks about whether the network shorted his show because it was giving all the goodies to Mad Men. Plus, Gilligan says being a good showrunner means being a cult leader. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm joined in the studio by my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, a lot of trouble in the movie business. I mean, as we've talked about in the past, the business is increasingly challenged and trying to figure out how to make the movie business work in the modern era, let's say. But for some reason, in the past few weeks, we've seen a lot of examples of troubled movies that are attempts to be these big, successful, splashy tentpoles, and then problems ensue.
No, the studios are taking, as we've said repeatedly, bigger and bigger swings with higher budgets, trying to kind of kill it with one movie. And I think they've realized over the last couple of weeks that these movies aren't quite ready to come out, and they have problems. Now, we don't really know what happened with The Great Gatsby, which is Baz Luhrmann's movie, which is pushed to next summer. But I think we do know a little bit about 47 Ronin, which is Universal's originally $170 million movie, which is probably well over $200 million right now, which was supposed to come out November 21 of this year, then was moved to February, and now is moved to December of 2013. So this is a movie that will now come out a year later than it was originally scheduled.
Yeah, 47 Ronin, a period piece, a samurai period piece starring Keanu Reeves, which, you know, an idea that doesn't really necessarily, you could give Universal credit for saying that's not an obvious thing to do, a period piece like that. But a huge budget, a completely untested director who had never done a feature film before, apparently fancied himself an auteur. Lots of clashes and conflicts resulted from that. Apparently certain sequences that were critical to the film weren't filmed at the time that they were intended to be filmed. Now they need reshoots. And this issue of reshoots, John, is just becoming like an epidemic in this industry.
Just look at Paramount's slate. I mean, Paramount is basically out of the movie business for the summer. I mean, Katy Perry is their entrance into the movie business for the year and until Paranormal Activity comes out. And this is a studio, I think, in particular, that's had any number of problems with reshoots and maybe we should call them reimaginings of their almost completed films.
Yeah, World War Z, the Brad Pitt zombie movie. They have to reinvent a whole third act for this movie. I mean, that's a very expensive and unusual situation, but they also pushed the G.I. Joe sequel, and they pushed this movie Hansel and Gretel. And as you say, there's just a spate of those movies that have gotten shoved. And even when they're not necessarily pushing the movie off their release date, there are still reshoots, which, you know, certain producers are saying to me, you shouldn't even call these reshoots. Reshoots are sort of a routine thing you do to tweak a movie. These are like additional photography and adding new material because in some cases either the wrong director was in the chair or the thing wasn't planned properly in the first place, which you have to do with these big effects movies very carefully, or both.
And the stakes are getting higher and higher. And J.J. Abrams, who has done the Star Trek movies, best known for doing Lost on television, said it is preposterous and embarrassing that movies cost what they do. Now, he is directing next summer's Star Trek sequel, which will cost close to $200 million. But what he is saying is that the wheels have almost come off, that so much money is being spent on these films that people haven't quite got a handle of what it is that they're doing. I'm quoting him now. And he says, I feel like it is incumbent upon filmmakers today to treat it like their own money, that so much money is being thrown at the screen that I think people are losing a sense of direction or purpose in Hollywood.
Certainly Shia LaBeouf, who was in Transformers and the last Indiana Jones installment, at 26 years old, has said he is sick of this. There is no room for being a visionary in the studio system. It literally cannot exist, he said in an interview this past week. And he says, he's not going to do these studio movies anymore. I don't know how long that will last, but big budget studio movies movies. He says he's out. He actually had some kind of salty language to describe the process of what the studios do to you.
It's odd that a 26-year-old would become the conscience of the industry, but I think he's learning as he goes. And he did have something interesting to say about Steven Spielberg, whose last Indiana Jones film Shia criticized at Cannes. And he said, quote, "He told me there's a time to be a human being and have an opinion, and there's a time to sell cars."
Yeah, and Shia LaBeouf said, "It killed my spirits because this was a dude I looked up to like a sensei."
Yeah. But I think what Shia is saying is something that is important, that, and he is in a independently financed movie called Lawless, which is coming out soon. But I think what he is saying is that Hollywood, in his mind, has lost its way. Its obsession with big movies and blockbusters has meant that the kinds of movies that most actors, and I have to say some members of the audience, are interested aren't getting made anymore. I suspect, however, his argument is going to fall on deaf ears in Hollywood.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. As many passionate fans know, Breaking Bad is the AMC series starring Bryan Cranston as a cancer-stricken high school chemistry teacher who cooks meth to pay his medical bills and eventually becomes a drug kingpin.
Do you know how much I make a year? I mean, even if I told you, you wouldn't believe it. Do you know what would happen if I suddenly decided to stop going into work? A business big enough that it could be listed on the NASDAQ goes belly up, disappears. It ceases to exist without me. No, you clearly don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No, I am the one who knocks.
Breaking Bad has won 6 Emmys, including 3 consecutive wins for Bryan Cranston. It's nominated for another 13 this year. The show is in that top tier of television programs, along with The Wire and The Sopranos. Breaking Bad's creator, Vince Gilligan, had been a writer-producer on The X-Files, and he'd written a few screenplays, including the 2008 Will Smith film, Hancock, but he'd never been a showrunner. When Gilligan first pitched the idea for Breaking Bad, FX bought it. But as FX president John Landgraf said in a recent interview on this show, he ultimately passed because the network already had 3 series with male antiheroes. At that time, Nip Tuck, The Shield, and Rescue Me. And Landgraf just couldn't pick up one more. But he quickly added,
"If I had known that Vince Gilligan was going to be one of the best showrunners in television and Breaking Bad was going to be literally one of the very best shows in television, I would have picked it up despite the concept."
Vince Gilligan recently sat down with the business producer, Darby Maloney, who asked him how, on his first television series, he became a showrunner who inspired such regret in a successful programmer like John Landgraf.
I want to preface this by saying I heard what John Landgraf said, and I want to say, if I may,
sure,
that he is an absolute class act, and no one has a crystal ball in this, but I would have made the same exact call if I were in his shoes. When I came to him with this show about a guy, middle-aged guy, dying of cancer, cooking meth, they had a mandate, as I understood it at the time, to get more women watching FX because they had all these anti-heroes. And also they had a show in hand that had a bona fide TV star attached, Courtney Cox.
Oh,
and
Dirt.
And they only had money to do the one show. But what makes him a class act is that he let our show go. He let it be bought by AMC. He did not bury it on the off chance, as it turned out, that it would actually go on to some success and become something of a, you know, what has become. And that is rare in this business. There's a lot of guys in his position at various networks around town who absolutely, I've had it happen myself, will not allow that. We'll just squash it, put it in a file drawer, let it collect dust, that first script, never let it go anywhere.
In going to AMC, maybe we'll stick with AMC for a second, and we'll get back to the showrunner
sure.
question. Unless you,
which
you
I
feel
don't
like
know that
can...
I have a great answer for. I feel Well, I feel like I've fallen ass backward into, I always say I feel like Kramer on Seinfeld, fallen ass backward into good luck. I did not know, I can tell you this for sure, I did not know going into this job that I'd be able to pull it off. I knew I could write for television. I had 7 years on The X-Files, which was, if there was anything I can point to as to why I'm able to do this job now, it's because I had 7 years on The X-Files working for Chris Carter, who was a wonderful writer and a wonderful showrunner and a wonderful teacher. You know, I was a good number three on that show. I didn't know I could jump to number one, as it were, and be able to pull it off. I said as a joke one time on a panel, they said, what does it take to be a good showrunner? And I blurted out, you need to be a cult leader. Mm. And as soon as I said it, I was joking. I was trying to get a laugh out of the audience. And as soon as I said it, though, in some sense, it felt right. That sounds like a weird thing to say, but you have to, the cult, instead of the cult being about you, the cult has to be about the show. You have to be the high priest or priestess, but you have to, what's the word, inculcate? Is that the right word? You have to
indoctrinate.
You have to get everyone enthusiastic, everyone from your writers to your director of photography to your cast, absolutely your cast, every department head, every member of the crew, all your producers. You have to get everybody pulling the rope in the same direction. And in that sense, you have to be something of a cult leader, you know, or a cheerleader, or whatever. Cheerleader is probably a more palatable term than cult leader.
Well, I don't know. Breaking Bad's pretty dark. <I think.
laughs> But you got to get everybody saying, "My God, I'll bleed for this show."
If you're just joining us, I'm Kim Masters, and we're talking with Vince Gilligan, the creator of Breaking Bad. The show is now in its fifth and final season. Last year, Sony Pictures Television, which produces the show, got in a heated negotiation with AMC over how many episodes Breaking Bad would get to wrap up its run. The previous year, AMC had done some high-profile bargaining with Mad Men creator Matt Weiner over the budget for that show. In her conversation with Vince Gilligan, Darby noted that some observers thought AMC had made such big concessions to Weiner that the network then put the squeeze on Breaking Bad.
I'm not trying to bait you into a conflict with Matthew Weiner here, but what do you make of that? It's out there in the public dialogue around the show.
Yeah, I would have had to have been deaf, dumb, and blind not to have heard all those accusations bandied about. From where I was sitting, I don't now, and nor did I then, see any truth to them. As to the question of Breaking Bad is getting short shrifted because of Mad Men, because Mad Men cost so much or whatever. The simple truth of it seems to me, is that Mad Men is a much more palatable show to advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard it described as a love letter to advertisers. It's obviously much, much more than that. It's a brilliant show, one of the very best written ever on television, and I enjoy it. I've seen every episode, and I enjoy it immensely. But it is also a show. I don't know if Matt was thinking of this he probably was not. He just wanted to tell a good story. But I'm sure he's very happy that it's a show that advertisers love. Because when advertisers love your show, you are golden. If advertisers truly love your show, it doesn't even matter if anyone's even watching it, just as long as advertisers want to put their name to it by paying for those 30-second spots. Breaking Bad is not an advertiser's dream of a show. The meth content, then the criminal. It's not even the criminal stuff. I think it's the specificity of the crime. The meth is not sexy. It is not in any way, shape, or form the kind of thing that a lot of big companies want to have their name attached to. I think that particular ice has been melting in the last 4 years, and we have more top drawer advertisers than we used to. But I think what it came down to last season was not that Matt Weiner's deal took money away from Breaking Bad. It was simply a matter of, is Breaking Bad the right place for a growing network to be spending its money when money could perhaps be better spent on other projects? And there was a time there when indeed probably Sony wanted more episodes than AMC wanted.
How many episodes did you want, though?
I got to tell you, we wound up with the right number of episodes. I couldn't be happier. I think 16 episodes is the perfect number. And when I say that, I want folks to understand, I don't want this show to end, because it is the most satisfying thing I've ever done. It's the best group of people I've ever worked with. It's the most creatively satisfying thing I've ever done. I fear it will be the most creatively satisfying thing I will ever do. But all good things must come to an end. And I don't want this show going past its height, its creative height. I don't want this thing to peter out. I don't want to start treading water creatively. I don't want this to be a show where people say, Breaking Bad, I used to love that. Is that damn thing still on? Wow, I didn't know that was still on. That's the worst outcome I could think of. I would rather leave people wanting more. And to that end, 16, because this is a story about transformation and change, because the idea here is to take the good guy protagonist, turn him, he turns himself, in fact, by force of will, into the bad guy. There's only so bad this guy can get. And then basically we made our point, and it's time to turn off the lights.
So you spend most of your time in the writer's room.
Yeah.
How much are you dealing with the budget side of things?
As little as possible.
Yeah.
I look at these spreadsheets and these budget documents and whatnot. I don't pretend to understand all the money into things that well, but they tell me if we can't afford
it. But sometimes the budget does dictate what you can write and what you can shoot,
absolutely.
Obviously. So can you give an example of something that had to change in a plot because of budget reasons?
Yeah. Like a good example, for instance, is we had an episode back in season 2 in which Jesse Pinkman's character sneaks into a junkyard. Basically, behind this tall chain link fence resided the RV.
Right, the mobile meth lab.
The mobile meth lab. And poor Jesse in this particular episode had lost his home, had nowhere to go. He was going to sleep in the RV because that's all he had left. He was going to climb this tall fence and get into this yard, but unbeknownst to him, there's this junkyard dog who's going to chase him and, you know, rip the seat of his pants and then keep him hostage in the mobile meth lab all night long. And it was a fun scene. My writer, Sam Catlin, did a great job writing it. And when it came time to shoot it, Stu Lyons, our physical producer, said, the dog's going to cost $25,000.
Wow.
And I said, well, why the hell does a dog cost $25,000? Well, we're going to have to. We're in Albuquerque. There's no dog trainer out here, a Hollywood-type dog trainer. We're going to have to fly a guy in from L.A.,
mm-hmm.
And he's going to need two dogs. He's going to need time to train both of them. You need a backup in case the one doesn't feel like working that night.
Right.
And I said, okay, well, whatever. And then he said, yeah, but we don't have an extra. We're way over on this one. We can't do it. So then Sam, the writer, and I are racking our brain, along with the director, John Dahl, did an excellent job on that episode. And we're standing there at the location racking our brains, and we look across the street, and there are literally 500 porta-johns across the street because apparently the city of Albuquerque stores them there in a field. So we quickly, Sam and I, came up with this idea of Jesse instead climbs the fence. There's a porta-john right on the other side of the fence, and he climbs on top of it because there's barbed wire on the top. It's easier to climb onto this thing. And as he stands on the roof of the porta-john, it collapses beneath his weight, and he winds up with all this terrible blue chemical nastiness all over him. And my point being, this limitation worked to the good because everyone's seen a junkyard dog scene. Everyone's seen a guy get the seat of his pants ripped out by a junkyard dog. I feel lucky that the budget limitation made us try a little harder because that scene is more indelible than a dog chasing a guy. Your poor guy covered with blue gunk and sobbing, you know, in a fetal position in a meth lab, you know.
Completely humiliating. Yeah. I mean, if he hadn't been humiliated enough already. And obviously, it cost a lot less money.
That cost a little over $5,000, buying a used porta-john, steam cleaning it out, rigging it with some less than nasty fake blue chemicals and rigging the roof and getting the stuntman to fall through the roof and whatnot. It was substantially cheaper. Yeah.
Coming up after a short break, Vince Gilligan fears for the future of the TV business if viewers insist on skipping ads. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with Vince Gilligan, creator and showrunner of the AMC show Breaking Bad. Currently in its fifth and final season, the show stars Bryan Cranston as a teacher turned meth cook and Aaron Paul as his one-time student turned business partner.
We're talking 200-300 boxes of sinus pills. There ain't that many Smurfs in the world.
We're not going to need pseudoephedrine. We're going to make phenylacetone in a tube furnace. Then we're going to use reductive amination to yield methamphetamine, 4 pounds.
So no pseudo?
No pseudo.
So you do have a plan. Yeah, Mr. White. Yes, yeah, science.
Okay.
Breaking Bad has had its share of graphic imagery, from the grim environment of a meth den to the violence perpetrated by a Mexican drug cartel. Gilligan recently spoke with the business producer, Darby Maloney, about the parameters, if any, set by AMC and Sony Pictures Television, the studio that produces the show.
There's violence in the show. There's very creative violence, but there can be graphic violence.
Oh, yeah.
Have you gotten notes saying, you know, tone it down, Vince, this is beyond the pale, or, you know, where are they standing on that end of things?
They are, no, we have never, well, yeah, okay, one time we had a throat-cutting scene at the beginning of season four. That was, I think, the only time. I mean, we have a broadcast standards department. That's a separate set of notes. That's a separate gentleman at AMC. That's AMC only.
Right.
You have to abide by the broadcast standards, which typically means on our show, they're counting the number of curse words.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very sort of Baroque set of rules. There's a couple of words there you could say 4 times per episode, a combination of words you can say 4 times. There's a certain F word that you can't ever say, except once a year we get to use it, except then it has to be dipped. They dip the volume, and we get that once a year. It's kind of
the writers
Baroque? I didn't mean Baroque. Byzantine. What word am I looking for? Anyway, it's complex.
It's archaic.
It's complex. Let me say it's complex.
Do the writers sort of fight over who gets to have that one F word? I want it for my episode.
We do. We don't fight over it per se, but we think long and hard about where to use it.
Sure.
Again, you know what? I have to say, I think it's an oddball rule, because if you're going to dip it, why not just be able to use it? But I think it's an aesthetic decision on AMC's part. They don't want to hear it, you know, all the time. However, when they show Scarface, you're hearing it all the time, dipped. So
mm-hmm.
it kind of, whatever. It's you know, you got to love your family, quirks and all, I suppose. But we get to drop the F-bomb, which we get to show unexpurgated on our Blu-ray and on our DVD. When we choose that moment, we choose it very carefully so that it has maximum effect. You don't want to it's your magic bullet. you want to fire at just the right moment. So, I suppose.
And you were saying that Standards and Practices had some notes on the throat cutting scene.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I tend to digress, don't
That's
I?
Okay.
The throat cutting scene was about the only time that violence that we had a note of violence. We had this was in the final cut version where we were asked to cut about 3 seconds of hemorrhaging, basically when this character got his throat cut, and I was a little annoyed at the time because I was thinking of how gory The Walking Dead is, but
zombie series,
which
on
is
AMC.
A great show, but they get away with stuff that I thought, man, this is nothing compared to that show. But they said, well, those are zombies. This is a living human being, and I said, okay, they all look the same to me. I don't know, a zombie and a real guy, but they bleed the same. At any rate, I got on my high horse a little when that note came down. Having said that, you know, watching it in hindsight, I don't miss the 3 seconds. It more than makes its point.
So in the modern TV landscape, there's like a new animal out there called the binge watcher.
Yeah.
Okay. People who, and I admittedly am one of those, who consume episodes of shows one upon another. And Netflix streaming allows this to be possible. iTunes allows this to be possible. There are all these different ways of consuming television other than that first episode run with the commercials in it, et cetera. Mm-hmm. How much are you aware that people binge watch Breaking Bad? And what do you think of that way of consuming it, the story?
I am pleasantly perplexed by it. I am at once very proud that I can hold someone's, or something I've worked on can hold someone's attention that long. And then I think, you know, man, how are you making a living? What's going on there? It's like, you know, but it's just, I heard a story actually. The first time this ever came into my consciousness, I heard a story, and I can't remember who told it to me, but it was about a woman who was in her final stages of pregnancy, and she had been watching, this was probably back in season two, she had sat down to watch season two on DVR or wherever she was watching it on. She was halfway through the last episode when she went into labor, and she stayed in front of the TV to finish watching in labor. I don't know if that was apocryphal. I don't know if someone was exaggerating the story to me. I love the story, though, and I hope the baby came out fine.
But from a business standpoint, it's interesting. I mean, Netflix has numbers on this, and from what I understand, the number of people who, if they started to watch season one, the amount of people that finished watching the whole season was 73%. Season two, if they started watching it, 81% finished the whole season. Season three, if they started it, 83%. So you can kind of assume, all right, I'm gaining viewers through this different way of getting it, to the point where your season premiere for season five was the highest, the most watched show you've had, right?
It's wonderful.
And
yeah.
I wonder how you think of that as somebody who works in this business. Granted, yeah, you don't think about money stuff, but like, wow, that's a whole new way of people buying into.
Oh, it is indeed. It's yeah, it's wonderful, but I do see the worry. This is a business. It's show business. And if there's no money to be made, these jobs, this wonderful job I have, and jobs just like it are going to dry up. So we should all be interested in how they monetize this stuff. And I think it's wonderful people are binge-watching this show. I say have at it. But I do see the companies, the various, not just ours, but the various companies' concern that if you're binge-watching on a DVR, you're skipping all the commercials. And if the guys who buy the commercials on your air realize that all their commercials are being skipped, they're going to stop buying the commercials. I got to tell you, what I don't want to see happen is a constant crawl. I don't want some bright guy coming up with the idea. And we've already got these awful bugs, they call them. It started off with a station identifier at the bottom of the screen, and now you've got these animated cars driving across the bottom of the screen, and, you know, watch this show next. And, you know, and now they've added sound effects to these awful things, and they are a harbinger of darker things to come, in which, you know, we can't sell commercials anymore, so we'll just give over a quarter of the screen permanently to some commercial for, you know, adult diapers or something. And you'll have to we'll have to reframe the show when we're directing it so that we don't use that quarter of the screen. We don't put anything important up there, because something that is DVR-proof, I fear that that is in the offing. I pray it is not, but you know, it worries me. It should worry all of us. That's how it worries me in an aesthetic and creative sense.
Sure.
Yeah. Because if no one's making money doing this stuff, then we're either going to have some version of that, or just everyone's going to be watching YouTube videos of people's dogs jumping into the pool. You know, we're not going to have shows like this anymore.
Well, Vince Gilligan is the creator and showrunner of the AMC series Breaking Bad, which is now in its fifth season. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Darby. This was fun.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime, on demand, with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.